That's devastating. But for me, I'm like, okay, let's go. How do I make sure that everyone knows that there is treatment, that treatment does exist? My story and my ability to relate to people, I really believe is what has made me a successful leader and ultimately what makes Charlie Health successful.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to episode 60 of the Mad Happy Podcast. I'm Payman.
And I'm Mason.
And today, Mason, who do we have today?
Today we have a really impressive guest. Her name is Carter Barnhart, CEO and founder of an amazing mental health company called Charlie Health. And what they do is they basically help you find appropriate treatment that can help with whatever situation you're in, whether it's trauma, loss, addiction, a bunch of different things that they basically help you find the treatment that you need. I know it's personally something that's really lacking. Growing up, I had a lot of people that would need to find a place to go, or even after I went away to treatment, a lot of people that come to me looking for a place or not really sure where to start can be really, really nervous and kind of hard to know who to trust. There's so many different options out there, and Carter's created a really safe and amazing company that really puts their clients first and has their best interest at heart. And I think part of the reason why she's so good at what she does and has such an inspiring story is because she actually lived it, going away to residential treatment as a teenager and seeing what that opportunity didn't have and how she wanted to build something in the world that she really wasn't able to get as a youth. She has a really powerful story that deals with sexual assault, and I think to hear how open she is about that was really inspiring for me, and how she's really turned it into a point of pride and something that she really owns and is now proud of. I know she serves as an inspiration to not only thousands of girls all over, but really just people, and I think the mental health industry as a whole. She's spoken at hundreds, if not thousands, of different schools and universities all across the country, and has a really, really impressive resume for someone who's still so young. So it was an amazing conversation. I always love talking to people who really live and breathe mental health every single day and truly dedicate their lives to helping others and providing mental health care for the masses. So definitely check it out. And if you know anyone who's struggling or could use resources of any kind, I really encourage you guys to check out Charlie Health, because it's a really, really amazing platform. And I think definitely the future of mental health care. So hope you enjoy the episode with Carter Barnhart. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the show with myself and Carter. Well, I'd love to just start with talking about what Charlie Health is. If you could share a little bit about what the company is, how old it is, and kind of a little bit of the inspiration behind why you started it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with the inspiration piece, because I think that's probably the most interesting.
Yeah.
I've spent my whole career working in behavioral health. Before I knew that my career was going to be behavioral health, though, I was a patient of behavioral health services. Similar to you, you know, bouncing in and out of different types of treatment programs, trying to find the right type of treatment as an adolescent. I unfortunately was sexually assaulted when I was 14, and afterwards struggled with anxiety, depression, PTSD, all the things that come along with some sort of assault. And it took my parents several years to find me the right type of treatment, the right type of treatment option. And I was lucky enough when I was 17 years old that they found a residential treatment center that specialized in treatment for girls with sexual trauma. I went there, was there for 45 days, had a life-changing experience. I was their second patient ever. So guinea pig experience went really well. and, you know, went back home, went back to high school, finished high school, and was obsessed with this idea of how lucky I was that I got access to care. Everyone that I met, I would tell them my story. It didn't make me the most popular girl in high school, as I would lead with like, let me tell you about my childhood trauma. But I wanted to make sure that everyone knew that there was treatment, and that treatment, good evidence-based treatment, could exist, and that it did exist. And so I reached back out to the founder of the treatment program between my freshman year of college, and asked if I could just come and intern for the summer, and then subsequently spent the next 10 years along his side growing it from a small 6-bed residential treatment center in Southern California to really what's known as the gold standard today in high acuity treatment for adolescents and young adults. And it was an incredible journey. It was amazing growing it, growing all of these residential treatment centers, but I was continually frustrated by just the lack of access. You know, our treatment was only available to people who could pay out of pocket or had Cadillac insurance plans. And that didn't seem fair. I joked that I often felt more like an admissions counselor, like a college admissions counselor, than a healthcare professional, because I was determining who would get the next bed in a residential treatment center.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to create something that was more accessible, and accessible for everyone, and accessible for everyone when they need it most. And that's really Charlie Health's mission, is, you know, to be there for people who need high acuity treatment, who need more than once a week therapy, and need it now, need it when they're in crisis and can't wait on a 6-week, 8-week waiting list, and don't have unlimited financial resources.
Yeah.
So over the last 2 years, and probably since we've talked last, we've treated thousands of patients in this virtual high acuity model that's 11 hours of therapy per week, that's group-based, that teaches teens and young adults that they're not alone, all facilitated by licensed master level clinicians. And it has been just an absolutely incredible journey and so inspiring. I think you probably, you know, the power of community, right? Just knowing that you're not alone, and bringing people together to share their stories. I'm so inspired by the kids that we serve.
That's amazing. I mean, I definitely had a similar experience when I went to a treatment facility in the summer of 2018 and really completely changed my life and my perspective on who I was, and that it was possible to get better, and that I did have a community of all these people. And similar to you, I've like preached the gospel of that place and have like sent a lot of members of my community who were struggling back there. But before we get into a little bit of more about your kind of background and that story, how does Charlie Health work exactly? Let's say I'm struggling or someone I know is struggling. What is kind of like the sign up and the intake part of it look like practically?
So we have a website. You can visit our website or you can pick up the phone and call us. We have staff 24/7 that is here and available to answer your call, and we'll explain to you different treatment options. We guarantee access to treatment within 24 hours of the first phone call. So let's say you were to pick up the phone and call us right now. We would get you scheduled for an intake tomorrow with a licensed master level clinician. Ideally, someone who sounds like you, someone who looks like you, someone who struggled in the same way as you. And then you would work with them to create a treatment program. Typically, that treatment program looks like 3 hours of group therapy, 3 days per week, plus 1 hour of individual therapy and 1 hour of family therapy. And family therapy can be whoever's in your life at this moment that can support you in your recovery journey, all through telehealth.
Yeah. What has been the hardest part of it for you in really scaling this business and like being able to take on all these patients and having that 24-hour window? Like, what's been the biggest challenge?
You know, I've been in this industry for a long time and I didn't think anything would shock me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't think that there was any worse story that I could hear. And when we launched in rural Montana, I just was overwhelmed by the profound struggle that so many of our kids were facing during COVID, being trapped in homes with parents that were really not healthy, not supportive, and the levels of really like abuse that we were hearing about on these intake phone calls. You know, I'm the last line on the admissions line. So if someone doesn't pick up, it rolls over to me. And the stories that I hear are heartbreaking. And I didn't think that my heart could break anymore. I think that's been one thing. It's just been how much more people are struggling now than they were 2 years ago, than they were 5 years ago after COVID and the impact that it's had on kids specifically.
It's an interesting point, because I think one of the silver linings of the pandemic that I kind of talked about was how much it brought mental health to the forefront of a lot of people's lives and really made that part of what they were talking about, what they were feeling, right? Like, we all lost these distractions and like ways to medicate ourselves outside of the house and really force us to deal with a lot of our shit that we had probably been suppressing. And obviously that comes with all of the harm of addressing these things and really dealing with them. But I do think that eventually it will kind of be better for us. And like, we do have to kind of get over that initial hurdle of what's actually going on to identify it and do the work and therefore kind of be better in the long run, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It is the silver lining of the pandemic, is that people are willing, one, to use telehealth, right? It used to not be common to like talk to your therapist through video. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't ever need to go back to my therapist in person. So much better that she's always accessible no matter where I am. And it just becomes so normal, right? To also talk about your feelings. I look at how it's changed also just our work environment, right? Like, our employees are constantly talking about how they feel, which that didn't really happen prior to COVID. People didn't have the vocabulary to advocate for themselves in the same way that I think they do now.
Yeah, I think anytime there's big change, it really gives us the opportunity to step back and kind of almost like see ourselves from like a different perspective and think like, why am I doing this? Or just because this is how things have been, like we get so stuck in these routines of our lives because we're all such creatures of habit who are trying to be highly productive and successful and work out and eat well and all these things that when you just put everything on pause, you finally get the chance to, or at least I did, really breathe and be like, what do I even want to do? Like, what do I like? Yeah. What do I not like? And we've been seeing that with our team and a lot of my friends at different companies too, to almost take control of their life back. And I know some friends who their jobs were going back in the office and they didn't want to go back in. So they left their job and they found another great job where they can work from home. And I think there's something really cool and special about that for a lot of people.
Yeah. You know, I traveled 300 days a year before COVID. So I was constantly on a plane, never having to sit with myself, right? Like I just was moving from place to place to place and then hitting the pause button during COVID and having to stay in one location. That in and of itself was a huge wake up call for me of how many hours I was just spending commuting or going.
Yeah.
And forced me to really do some more work, right? We all think we're like done doing the work on ourselves and then you get another opportunity and you're like, oh, this is still there. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a lifelong journey. And I think the biggest struggle for me is I only really feel the motivation when I'm in kind of pain or crisis. And like, that's when I'll kind of really devote myself to recovery and working on my mental health. And then like, I'm always in this kind of cycle where I'll, you know, maybe my relationship is in jeopardy or my imposter syndrome is really acting up. And I feel that sense of urgency. And it's like, all right, I'm back in 12-step. I'm going every day. I'm on with my therapist. Do that for a month. Things feel more manageable now. And I kind of go back to it. It's like my ego gets in the way again of like, you got this, dude. And then that's kind of like my cycle that I'm currently working on. I'm like trying to break.
I think it's really hard to break that cycle. And I think most people get into that, right? Where they're so used to the crisis. It's something that I really love actually about working with adolescents is that you can intervene at the first crisis so that it doesn't have to be that constant crisis state and that you learn that crisis is when you like get the response that you're looking for, right? Mm-hmm. Like shit hits the fan, then everyone pays attention. But instead, if you can teach an adolescent young, like, okay, shit doesn't have to hit the fan. Like we can start working on ourselves before the next crisis. We can start using these skills so that that crisis doesn't happen. Because I too often wait until things blow up. And then I'm like, wait, there were warning signs. I could have started this.
I know.
I could have started working on this weeks ago. What happened?
Yeah. And with adolescents especially, I think it's so just imperative to really reach them. And obviously that's a huge part of our demographic, are like teenagers and young adults in their 20s. And for them to understand how important their mental health is and really get to know themselves and do the work and be able to identify these feelings and things like that, I know for me was monumental because the stakes can be lower than when you are kind of an adult, or at least for me, like, you know, my struggles with relationships, like I'm so grateful that I wasn't married or had children or in a family, or, you know, people who struggle with gambling that don't have mortgages yet, right? Like they're still in college. I feel like it's such a time to really reach people and really like shape them while we're still kind of figuring things out before it's really like life-changing blow up stuff, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
To go back to when you said the incident that you experienced as like a teenager, I know you said it took you a few years to really find a place that felt good for you to go to. I'm curious if you could just speak on your experience of like trying different places, what made them not suitable for you for those few years? And then just hearing you talk about how vocal you were about it, sharing with people, I feel like that's super uncommon to be almost like proud of it and like feel empowered. Yeah. I didn't really sense a lot of like shame coming from you, which I think is also super unique. If you could just share a bit about like that experience and like why you think you were so compelled to really let your story be known and not feel ashamed of it.
Yeah. You know, after I was assaulted, I started acting out, right? Started doing things because I didn't like myself, whether that was restricting or different forms of really harming myself. And my parents got worried and sent me to a therapist. that therapist, the first therapist that I went to, didn't ask any questions about, like, have you been through anything traumatic, right? And I didn't think to share it. I'd never shared it with anyone. And I think that's the case for a lot of people, or I know that's the case for a lot of people, that something awful happens, some sort of severe trauma happens, and they don't tell anyone because, exactly like you said, that shame, right? And so for me, I was just living with it, carrying it around, and not talking about it in therapy. I went to a therapist that was just a talk therapist. And generally, the conversation was pretty light. And I would be frustrated why I wasn't feeling better, that they weren't asking questions. They weren't asking if I had experienced any form of trauma. I told my parents that that therapist wasn't working, and they sent me to a different therapist, then to a psychiatrist. But in none of those appointments did anyone ever ask the why. You know, it was always so focused on the behaviors of, like, okay, how can we help you get out of bed tomorrow morning? Mm-hmm. Not why are you struggling to get out of bed? What is getting in the way of you getting out of bed? It was always about my maladaptive coping mechanisms. And that's really how I label it. However I was maladaptively coping for that day became the focus of therapy. It was never about, like, let's peel back the layers of the onion and figure out why you're coping in this way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I would go to therapy with my parents as well. I had really loving, incredible parents. And two, it was always about the drama of the week. It was never that, like, zoom out. And, you know, when I was 17, I was still really struggling. I'd been in therapy for like 2.5 years. And my parents went to my pediatrician and said, like, is Carter ever going to be like her classmates? Is she ever going to jump out of bed in the morning or whatever, whatever they wanted a 17-year-old to do? And they said, you know, she just seems like she's constantly depressed and we can't get out of this depression cycle. No matter what medication we try, no matter what we try, we can't get out of this cycle. And they started to ask me questions about why. And finally, I disclosed in my parents why I was really feeling the way that I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And I don't think even at the time I knew, you know, I laid out like 10 different things that had happened, right? And my parents had more shame than even I had, right? They were like, how did we not know this? Yeah. How did we not know that this was going on with our daughter? And then they became obsessed with finding me the right form of treatment. And luckily, they discovered this residential treatment center that was specifically for girls ages 14 to 17 years old that had been through similar things to me. And I remember moving into that house and meeting my roommate, and she shared her story with me. And it was the first time I had heard someone else share that looked like me, that sounded like me, and also had sexual trauma and had been through something similar. And then four other girls moved into the house, and their stories were almost identical as well. I'm still in touch with four out of the six girls today.
Wow.
One of them's wedding is coming up. She was texting me today with all of her different wedding dresses. You know, I formed lifelong friendships with the people that I was in the house with, really through shared experience, through hearing every single day, me too, I feel like this, me too, I feel like that, and learned that my feelings were normal. And then I started to feel like my feelings were actually a superpower. Right? Because I had, in 45 days, developed these really deep relationships with these girls in this house that I didn't have in my life prior. So I was like, how do I have this type of relationships with everyone? Maybe if I just tell everyone about my trauma right off the bat, then we'll all be super close. And so that was a journey too, figuring out how to, you know, make those same really deep relationships that I found could exist in a typical high school setting.
Now, there's something so powerful about that story and resonates with me a lot, obviously, from my experience there too. Like, just the people that you meet and the experience that you have is so close and vulnerable, and, you know, sharing things that you've never shared with anyone else before, that you do create such a special bond, and in turn really improved all of my relationships back at home, because it just gave me such a newfound perspective on letting go of that shame, like not carrying it around with me all the time, really like accepting, like you call it, your superpower. Like, these are things that make me who I am, that are part of my story, that are things that I can't go away, even if I don't talk about them and try and forget about them, right?
Right.
They're in my brain, and like they're stored in my body and like in my experience. So like the moment that you can really embrace that and like own it, it just unlocks such another level, and just to understand that you're not alone. You know, I think of when I went to like my first SLAA meeting, I didn't know anybody in the room with me, and I felt more connected than I had the last 2 years of my life, right? In this like room full of strangers. I would call the 12-step meetings of my family of strangers, but it's so funny to me how, you know, we hold these things in because we don't want to, like, just because we think that it won't like help us or service us in any way, or like will be a burden. And it's really the opposite of, like, you know, once you were able to open up about that, like, that's when your parents like were there for you and you built this community and like all these things. And it's often ourselves that are like keeping us stuck. So that's why I feel like just talking about it is like so important. You know, we know that we're not doctors or professionals here at like Mad Happy and Local Optimist, but our mission is really just to create conversation and share stories and like listen to people like you to just inspire other people to just have conversations with people in their support system who love them and care about them. And I think we'd all be so surprised kind of what that would lead to and truly have the ability to like change the world and how people think about these kind of things.
Absolutely. I think too, I mean, FLAA specifically, right? There still is just so much stigma. There's stigma with everything. But I think that seeing people like you, hearing people like you share their experience, I mean, that's really what changes the perception, right? It changes how people view those communities. It changes how they view themselves. I know for me that so much of my healing has been seeing people who inspire me, who I think are, for maybe all the wrong reasons, who I think are pretty, who I think are cool, who I think are whatever, be vulnerable. And when I see them be vulnerable, when I hear them share their experience with sexual trauma or whatever it may be, right away, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be okay. Right. And I still have days that I need to be inspired by other people. I'm sure you do too. Yeah. when you like have that, like you said at the beginning, the imposter syndrome, oh, the worst. You know, I was laying in bed last night saying that I was going on to this today. And I was like, how am I ever going to be able to speak about my story on this? This is so scary. It's so overwhelming. Who cares about my story? And it's going back to that first principle, right? Of like, if you impact one person, that's enough. And I think that's for all of us, we have to remember that it's not about mass impact today. If we impact one person and we make one person feel more comfortable in their own skin, that's a big win.
Yeah. Well, hopefully this hasn't been too scary for you yet. But I love what you were saying about your experience with those therapists early on. And like, they were often using your behaviors as part of the problem. And it's what I talk about with addiction all the time is like, these aren't the problems. These are solutions to a deeper problem. Right.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious for you, as you were building out the different like sort of curriculum or modalities of Charlie Health, how did you think about like approaching what sort of people to work with and like how you really wanted to build and shape like your program?
Oh, that's the magic. Thank you for asking that question. That's my favorite thing to talk about.
Yeah.
So because of my own experience and my chief clinical officer, who's our co-founder's experience in and out of treatment, we wanted to make sure that we use our own personal experiences to really inform the creation of Charlie Health, in addition to our years and years and years of industry experience. For both of us, and probably for someone like you, you know, the power of connection, right? We know that that's real. We know that hearing "me too" is the best words that you can hear in a therapy session. And so we wanted to create groups where people would feel like they were with their peers instantly. So how do you create an instant connection, especially over telehealth, right? Especially over Zoom with strangers who live, you know, at the opposite corners of the state that you live in. The first thing is really perfecting our group matching. And so how we've done this group matching is we've paired kids together based on their age, based on if they would like to be in a single gendered group, or what gender they identify as, if they want to be with patients who identify as the same gender as them, age, gender, and then maladaptive coping mechanism. If they want to be in a group where they're talking about using substances to cope with their trauma, great, we have that for you. But if instead you want to be in a trauma-focused group where we're talking about the trauma, and we're talking about the why, we have a group for you. And so it's not just focused on like, what's the primary diagnosis, or it's not just focused on like, what's the presenting problem. Instead, we ask all of these different questions about like, how do you cope with this? Why does this happen? And then also, most importantly, what do you like? We have kids who love cosplay. Great, let's put you into a group with five other kids who love cosplay. And on Fridays, you guys can all come dressed however you want for a group. Or you have purple hair. Can we put you into group with other girls who have purple hair who also have sexual trauma and have one suicide attempt? Yes, we have that in our program. We're able to do such curated groups that we can give anyone a cohort of peers that they are going to relate to, because we have the thousands of kids in our program who are struggling, who need more than once a week therapy and are in some sort of crisis, but are also humans and want to be with people who they can relate to and look like and sound like. Do you want to be in groups with people with a Southern accent? Because that's going to make you feel more comfortable. Great. We have that. We can go off of preferences. We can go off of diagnosis. We can go off of coping skills. Let's figure out where you are going to feel the most comfortable. And where we've seen a huge, huge interest is from the LGBTQIA community, wanting to be in groups of people who look and sound and are struggling with the same things that they're struggling with. You know, we have a non-binary group that are all 16-year-olds, and then we have a separate group for 14-year-olds that identify as non-binary. Like that's, it's so important for us to give those opportunities and those specific groups and opportunities for connection to people who really need it.
Yeah, that's amazing that it can be so tailored. I think about some of the rooms that I have been thrown into. I mean, my core group when I first got to residential treatment was me and all girls. And I was just like, you know, I don't think this is the best for me right now with like what I'm struggling and like being really depressed after my last relationship. And I didn't really have an option. And I think there was something sort of like beautiful and like meant to be about it at like the same time. It was like some sort of sign, but I think that's really great. Is there any hesitancy towards grouping people with just a bunch of different people that they're similar to? Obviously, I know like mental health is you want to be able to relate to everyone. Do you think about kids gaining different perspectives from different kids, or is it really just about I need to really see myself in all these other people to feel like I can connect?
So when they first enter our program, they're typically in our program for about 8 weeks. And in the beginning, it's really important for them to be with people who are struggling with similar things.
Yeah.
Because also the therapeutic interventions that they're going to benefit from are going to be the same as their peers. Some of our clients need DBT. Some of our clients don't need DBT.
Yeah.
Some of our clients need CBT. Some of our clients don't need CBT. And so if you're someone who would benefit from a DBT program, typically that's someone who has had maybe multiple suicide attempts, right? So that cohort is going to look very similar for them as they're receiving that intensive treatment.
Yeah.
Post 8 weeks in our alumni program, that's much more about mixing patients together. So you're not with that hyper-curated group anymore, because it's not as intense of a therapeutic intervention. And you're absolutely right. It's important to be able to relate to people who, just because I struggle with depression and anxiety, doesn't mean I shouldn't be able to relate to someone who struggles with bipolar, right? Like we all have mental illness. We all have things that we're struggling with.
Yeah.
And being able to relate to other types of people is incredibly important. Just in that first 8 week intensive, it's generally best to have kids together who are struggling with very similar things.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I've told this story before, but I was surrounded by a room of people that I felt like I couldn't relate to at all at first. You know, someone who had lost their kids and was grieving, someone who was dealing with PTSD as a veteran. And here I was just like a 24-year-old kid who, you know, felt like I didn't deserve to be in that room, or like, why am I here? My story is not as bad as these people. And it took me a couple weeks to kind of get over that hurdle of not feeling like I belong. And really, once I understood, like, we're all feeling the same things beneath the surface, even if above ground our lives look completely different, you know, we're still the same human beings at the end of the day that still feel things in the same way. So that's when I was able to really like connect and tap in more to like the feelings than just like what the actual stories were.
Yeah. And I think if you think about that, that was, you know, 24/7 care for 2 weeks, right?
Totally.
8 weeks of 9 hours of group therapy probably gets you to a similar place after 2 or 3 weeks of residential treatment.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Where you're ready to that broader connection. And it's hard sometimes when people don't, especially when you're an adolescent. Think about back to when you were in like middle school. When you were in middle school, high schoolers were like a totally different type of person. You wouldn't want to tell a high schooler that you were struggling socially or whatever it is. In those years, like 12 to 15 years old seems like a lifetime in between.
Yeah.
So it's important that we give them people who they feel comfortable around.
I'm curious for you, like, what are you seeing that kids are really struggling the most with right now? Yeah. And Has that sort of shifted at all in the last 2 years since Charlie Health started? And where do you see things kind of going for that generation? You know, I know for us, like the Gen Z especially has been so inspirational in how they talk about their mental health and how open they are with each other and themselves, and so expressive and comfortable and like forming these groups and communities and not caring what anybody else has to say has been really beautiful to see. And then I know on the flip side, we see all these things about teenage girls and social media and just a bunch of different things that are really tragic. What are the biggest like ongoing issues from your perspective?
Yeah. You know, when I got into this industry 12 years ago, we were fighting pill parties. That was the big thing that I would go and speak at high schools about, was do not take pills out of the medicine cabinet at a keg party, at these big house parties. It's mm-hmm. incredibly dangerous. You don't know what those pills are. And it was a lot of education around partying and how we were going to combat people accidentally overdosing from partying and house parties and things like that, and drunk driving. Teens today, we've gone the opposite direction. You know, the new drug of choice, I say these days, is isolation. What we see the most is teens who are scared to leave their bedrooms, who are not going to parties, whose anxiety is debilitating. And we really need to help them. And I think a lot of that has been amplified by COVID, right? They've been forced to stay in their homes. And the social anxiety is really the biggest thing that we're fighting today. Our chief clinical officer does a beautiful talk on isolation is the new drug of choice, to help really our parents, the parents of our kids, understand what their kids are going through right now. And everything we're seeing on TikTok, on Instagram, in the news, I think a lot of that comes out of that isolation, right? Spending a ton of time just alone on your phone and getting your self-worth from there. Gen Z, it's my favorite thing about our job is that I get to work with Gen Z every day. And you're right, they're incredibly bright, outspoken, not scared to tell you how they feel and to challenge the status quo. And so I believe if any generation can overcome some sort of struggle, it is this generation that will really be able to heal these feelings of isolation and loneliness that you see across the board right now.
Yeah. What do you feel like is something that you've maybe learned from some of these patients or ways that like they've opened you up to thinking about things differently for yourself?
I love how Gen Z questions everything.
Yeah.
Growing up, I didn't think to question everything. And I now question, they really have influenced my ability to have confidence in questioning everything.
Yeah.
How about you?
I think just being like unapologetic, I think in a way, like I think really for me, my social experience and upbringing was so like fitting in. And I feel like they're just all about standing out, you know, and I think it can be like annoying for people or who aren't used to it or who get it. Or even I have a younger sister who's a junior in college, and I just think how much more like independent and I'm gonna do what I want she is than like any of me or my siblings were at her age. And it's not in like a rude or like disrespectful way, it's just in a way of like, this is who I am, and like I feel comfortable in myself, and if you want to have a conversation about it, we can have a conversation about it, but like this is why I'm doing it. And it's like, okay, that's very mature and like respectable. And I think it's challenged me a lot to think about who I hang out with, why I hang out with them, when I start to judge other people or feel judgments on me, like just be more comfortable with like who I am and make decisions for myself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime I need that like boost of confidence, I'll pop into some of our groups and I'll hear our clients just saying the most beautiful things about themselves. And I think so often my peers, we rarely celebrate ourselves. And I've watched how our patients really take pride in celebrating each other and then also celebrating themselves. And there's something really beautiful about that, that confidence, knowing what you want, owning what you want. We should all be more like that.
Totally. Before we wrap up, I want to talk a little bit about the like speaking engagements that you do like at all these high schools. I know that's through like a foundation that you started. Is that right?
That is correct. And then also through my work at Newport Healthcare as well. Spoke at a lot of high schools through that as well.
Nice. Yeah. I'm curious just like what the foundation is, kind of what the mission of it is, and then what that high school tour has been like. I think it's honestly like a passion of mine is speaking to young kids, especially like men, and like speaking about boys' mental health, and just would love to hear a little bit about like your experience with that.
You know, it was incredible when I was on the road, like I said, 300 days a year before COVID, and went all around the U.S. speaking at different high schools and really just speaking about mental health, speaking about my struggles, speaking about my journey. And I watched even in, you know, I started doing it when I was 18 and then COVID hit, let's see, when I was, I guess, 29. So I did it for a long time. And it was the best way for me to really understand what was going on in our high schools and to be educated and to be in touch with what students need. I was just amazed at, through every high school that I went to, the different connections, the different stories that I would hear, and the different people that I had the opportunity to meet, and how great students were at advocating for themselves. I also got to see firsthand just the state of mental health support in our country. The majority of high schools that I went to would have one school counselor, maybe two, and that would be for a large student body. And so the students would raise their hands after I would speak when I would talk about how therapy saved my life. And they would say, okay, that's great for you, Ms. Carter. What about us? We have one school counselor and there's a wait list for 8 weeks, 10 weeks, 12 weeks. Or my parents can't afford therapy. What do I do when my parents can't afford therapy and the school counselor is too busy to see me? So more than inspiring students, I would say really my high school tours inspired me. You know, I think a lot of the work that I do today is based off of those experiences of seeing people outside of like the coastal towns that we all live in, seeing people throughout the country who really want help, who really want to be in treatment and are unable to access it, which is what keeps me up at night. I did start this nonprofit, which was designed for early intervention and also to help people help navigate resources in communities and help people get access to free mental health resources and be a navigator in communities. And unfortunately, the biggest issue was that just the resources didn't exist. Support groups are great. Being able to go to places like 12-step groups are awesome. But for so many kids who have really deep trauma that they need to deal with, they need clinicians who are trained. They need access to a psychiatrist or a nurse practitioner. They need that really more sophisticated care to deal with the tremendous struggles that they're faced with on a daily basis, internally and externally. And I think, I hope that I inspired some students along the way, but for me, it was really, it really taught me a lot about myself and about our country and about what we need to do to actually make an impact on the youth mental health crisis.
No, for sure. I would definitely be willing to bet that you inspired one or two kids along the way. What does your mental health kind of look like now for you? And do you struggle at all with hearing so much of these stories and experiences and like taking those on, being such like an empathetic and caring person? Like, how do you balance that? And like, where do you kind of put that when you think about prioritizing your own self-care?
You know, it's a hot topic recently. We've hired a lot of people at Charlie Health who have never worked in mental health treatment before. Prior in my other role, I was always hiring clinicians or people who had experience.
Yeah, they're used to the trauma, yeah.
And they're used to the trauma, exactly. And we've hired a lot of people who are not used to the trauma. And they'll hear me on phone calls or they'll hear me talk about things really lightly. And they're confused, right? And they're like, how do you not, you know, stay up at night about this? And I think I'm really lucky that for me, it really inspires me. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning. Like hearing a sad story about how someone bounced in and out of an ER, maybe has had, you know, 20% of our kids have had three or more suicide attempts within the previous 90 days. So sometimes we talk to families that have had like six suicide attempts, and that's a 12-year-old girl in their house who's had six suicide attempts. That's heartbreaking. That's devastating. And then you hear the why behind it and you find out that there's years and years of sexual trauma. That's devastating. But for me, I'm like, okay, let's go. Like, we got to win this war. And that's just my mentality. And I think that's been my mentality since the beginning, has been like, how do I win this? How do I make sure that everyone knows that there is treatment, that treatment does exist? And I think, like I said, like I started with, it's my superpower, my story and my ability to relate to people, I really believe is what has made me a successful leader. And ultimately what makes Charlie Health successful is that we get to go out and share our experience and inspire people and offer them life-saving access to treatment. But it's hard. I mean, yes, it's hard listening to sad stories all day, every day. Definitely. We have a really great way of celebrating wins of our patients at Charlie Health. So we do closing circles for every patient who's been with us for after 8 weeks. They have like a little graduation from intensive treatment. And everyone at Charlie Health is invited to the closing circle. So whether you're an engineer, whether you're back office, you're invited to the closing circle for the patient. As long as the patient's okay with you attending, we ask them first. And that is the magic. I mean, you get to walk in and you see these patients who come in and they're like, you know, before I came to Charlie Health, I wasn't speaking. I wasn't getting out of bed. I wasn't doing this. And you get to hear these stories where people feel so much better. I always joke that, you know, we're like the bottom of the ocean. They get to like bounce off. And then we get to see them like swim up to the top. And it's the most beautiful, amazing thing ever. Yeah. And then they get to live these lives like beautiful dolphins. So
that's amazing. I talk about things very casually too, just because I'm so open and people are definitely a bit taken back. But what I say all the time is that these things are such a normal part of our lives and they have such a stigma around them that it's like, you know, people have visceral reaction to a word like suicide or sexual abuse and things like that, but they're not casual, obviously, but like we need to talk about them in a way that almost is casual so people understand how present they are in society and they're not these like boogeyman type words that like you can only be in a dark room with a therapist to bring up.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, I mean, I've watched how my story has evolved over like what I've shared has evolved over the past 12 years of working in this space.
Yeah.
I used to just say I had childhood trauma.
Right.
And now I come out right away. And I say I was sexually assaulted at a concert when I was 14. And it breaks the ice, right? And then we're talking about it. And then parents know also, I mean, the amount of parents that say to me, like, I've never asked my kid if like anything bad's ever happened to them. I just assumed they were safe. And I hope that people like you and like me having these conversations can help the next generation know that, you know, healing exists and normal people struggle too.
Before we wrap up, I have two more questions for you that we ask every guest on the show. The first one is if you could nominate anyone to come on our show who's been a big inspiration for you or who has a powerful mental health story, whether you know them or not, who would it be?
Well, this is a little bit of a cop-out, but our chief clinical officer, I think, has like the best mental health story ever. And I would nominate her because I think she's a phenomenal speaker. And I think she has an incredible story. Her name's Dr. Caroline Finkel. We actually were in treatment together as teenagers and now run Charlie Health together.
Amazing. Well, you'll have to connect us.
I'll make the intro. I think I can make that one happen. Yeah.
And then lastly, Carter, what makes you mad happy?
Success stories. Hearing stories of success. Talking to people like you who have been through shit and have had bad days. And can get on and do incredible things with their life. Client success stories are my biggest thing. I have a folder in my room at home in my bedside drawer where I keep all the thank you letters from clients. And anytime I'm feeling down, I read them. And that makes me really mad happy.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on everything with Charlie Health. We'll be sure to link the website and everything in the show notes so people can check it out. And yeah, I really appreciated the conversation and I think our audience will as well.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
Likewise. Thank you guys so much for listening. It always means so much to us. I hope that you're able to learn something from Carter and her story. And I think these people always get me to like open up and really challenge me on like a lot of my stuff too. So I think that's always kind of tough in the moment, but ends up being fun too. So you got to learn a little bit about me as well. Yeah, thanks for listening. Hope you're having a beautiful day and we'll be back next week. See ya. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.